With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some very important conversations lined up for you. Coming up, for American Stroke Month, which is recognized here in the month of May, I'm going to talk to Dr. Mitchell Elkind, Chief Clinical Science Officer for the American Heart Association. We'll explain everything you need to know about strokes and how to prevent them. Right now, to get things started, though, I want to bring in my first guest. I'm joined by the Chief Executive Officer of the Dan Marino Foundation, Mary Parton. Last month, the month of April, was National Autism Acceptance and Awareness Month, and that is the focus of the Dan Marino Foundation. You can learn more at danmarinofoundation.org. Mary, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to come on the show. And first of all, tell us about the mission of this foundation and how this all got started.
Our mission is to empower people with autism and other developmental disabilities. Now the term being used rather than developmental disabilities are neurodiverse populations, and that includes people with autism. I mean, it includes mental health aspects, dyslexia, ADA, ADHD. So it's a pretty wide spectrum. You know, we started out with autism, and if you would see that as central to everything that we've done at the foundation. But after 31 years in operation, you know, your scope begins to expand. And so now we are serving a greater number. But the mission still remains to empower people so that they can live their best life possible, you know. And that's really where we have seen needs. That's really the pathway of how the foundation has grown. It started in 1992. Dan and Claire Marino, their second son, Michael, they thought around the age of 18 months, age two, that maybe he was deaf. They really didn't know, you know, back then, 30-some years ago, you really didn't hear about autism very much. You had seen the movie Rain Man, but that was about it. And so when they went to the pediatrician and they went to a neurologist, he was diagnosed with autism. And Claire talks about coming home, and Danny was at practice. He came home, and they got in the encyclopedia to look it up because they didn't know what it was. And so their journey really started the foundation in that when they would go, and they had the means to find the best of care and the best practices that were out there at the time, but they would see so many families that did not. And so that was the first huge initiative of the foundation, was in building the Dan Marino Center, which is out in Weston. It was originally with Variety Hospital. It became then Miami Children's Hospital, and today it's the Nicklaus Children's Hospital. And that opened in 1998. It's actually celebrating its 25th year. And so what this was really a huge new initiative. It was a one-stop shop. It was central that families could come and get diagnosis, and then all of the doctors were there. So, because there's some comorbidities, if they had heart issues, or whether it be ophthalmology or behavior, you know, or psychology, whatever the means were, all of the therapies could be found in this one center. And that still to this day serves about 29,000 young people a year, and that's from birth up until age 22. And it's actually spawned that one center about another 11 centers in the Florida area, and actually one internationally in Sardinia in Italy. So that was the very first initiative of the foundation. And then what happened was, over the years, children who had been diagnosed and received treatment at the center, they began to be teenagers. They began to be young adults. And the parents came to the foundation saying, well, my son would like to have a summer job, or my son, now that he's transitioned out of high school, needs some sort of post-secondary or some kind of training. And that really then is how the foundation expanded its programs. We had, like in 2007, we started summer employment programs that were high school programs. And then in 2013, we actually opened up the first post-secondary program called Merino Campus. And 2 years later, we opened up a second school at FIU on the main campus. And now at this point in time, actually our new program, we've had thousands of young people come through the school who are now adults. And so for September of 23, we're actually expanding into like a club membership. And they can be people who have either graduated or been in programs with foundation or not. Just young people who are looking for extra supports for employment, for socialization. And so that's something that we'll be announcing, you know, in the next couple months. So we continue to evolve. And I think that's what... you ask me what's unique about what we do. We're very individually centered with the young people that we serve, be they babies that need diagnosis or treatments as they're coming up, or as adults. You know, we're always evolving with our population on what those needs are.
We're joined by Mary Parton, Chief Executive Officer of the Dan Marino Foundation. You can learn more at danmarinofoundation.org. Tell us when you became part of the foundation and some of the more notable developments that you've been a part of as this foundation has grown, like you just described.
Well, I've been here 25 years. And when I came, the foundation, the Dan Marino Center was just opening. And so much of the evolution, I mean, we actually built a second floor. And I think one of the most notable things that I did and led at that time, we had a three-year-old at the time at the center, and he was doing very well, but then he unfortunately drowned. And I had been aware that, first of all, drowning is a big thing for four-year-olds and under, especially in South Florida. It was the number one cause of death. But especially children with autism are very fascinated by the water. It's calming. And so there were a lot of drownings in our community. And so I went to Tallahassee to work on laws that every pool that served young people, that they would have to have a training, a disability. And so it became known as the Merino Aquatics certification. And so that meant every pool, every city pool, every YMCA, every Boys and Girls Club, that they would have to take this course. And it made them more cognizant on how to work with children that had differing abilities, you know, who maybe were afraid of sound, or, you know, that they would just react. So it allowed them to train and them to swim, or at least water safety. And at the same time then, in going to Tallahassee, I was able to get the dollars to build an aquatic center at the Dan Marino Center. And working with the city of Weston, they really helped us to be able to accommodate that we could do that. And that was the only one in the state, and that's in 2003. So that was a pretty big deal. And then really, I would say the Merino campuses, we had worked with young adults for a long time. And then, you know, we did the summer programs, and we did some kind of seasonal programs. And then I thought, you know, this is so necessary. I see such a transformative change in young people that why don't we do this year round? And then that became the nemesis of starting the Merino campus, a post-secondary program. And then other thing, I'm a champion for technology. One of the biggest, we really focus on employment with our older individuals. And because so much of who you are is what you do. You work in the radio. Hi, I'm Mary. You know, I work at the foundation. And I saw a lot of our young people, they didn't have that entree into the community. And so that was the importance of employment. Well, I saw at the time, for over two decades, the number was 13% employment for our population. And so I started to look at, well, what are the big challenges? What are the roadblocks here? And one of them was interviewing. And so at the time, the best practice model was these mock interviews, you know, having volunteers come in and you'd interview. But I thought, well, with technology using avatars, we could set different scenarios, have different demeanors of interviewers, and young people could practice. And with practice comes perfect. And so that was a huge in creating what we called VITA. I went out to USC, their Institute of Creative Technology, because they were really leading at the time. And this is 2011-12, and actually worked with Colonel Schilling, who was the commander of DARPA at the time. And the military had developed these avatars. And I knew that if I pitched it, I was going to ask if we could use them, you know, but to change them up for our population. And little did I know that Colonel Schilling had children with autism, and the head of pediatrics for the defense had children with autism. And so they were wonderful. And that was really the birth of the use of technology. And we've continued to grow that through the foundation on communicating at a party scenario, you know, individual right. skills, how to take transportation, you know. So it's all grown from there. So those are some of the more, notable things that I've been very instrumental in.
I'm Ryan Gorman here on iHeartRadio Communities, joined by Chief Executive Officer for the Dan Marino Foundation, Mary Parton. How prevalent is neurodiversity, and what are some of the signs of autism?
Okay. Well, you know, in autism, there's not a blood test or something like that. It's really diagnosed by professionals making a judgment on a child's behavior. And the things you look for are communication, where they don't communicate the same. Maybe they don't verbalize, or you've always heard, well, gee, they were talking, and now at age two, suddenly they don't, or they're not speaking anymore. Socializing is another thing. Not making eye contact, not being sound. You can get up behind a child and make a very loud sound and they don't react. Yet they're very sensitive to the fluorescent lights, that sort of thing. They look for unusual or repetitive behaviors. But these are all kind of, again, you really, if a parent is thinking that, not sure what's going on, you go to your pediatrician, you go, if they're within school, you go to your school. Always, you've given the contact information for the foundation. You can call here. So the first thing is, like anything, if you suspect something's not quite right or, you know, developmentally, then search out, you know, and have an evaluation. Because the earlier you get treatment, and treatment basically is behavioral, ABA it's called, and it's really training to make eye contact, training speech, that sort of thing. But the sooner you get these therapies, the better results that you have. So that's what I'd say. The number of children diagnosed, it was just changed again, CDC. And what they do, they base this, they go like in 11 states, and they go to the health and school records, and they focus on 8-year-olds. And they look at that number of how many children are diagnosed in that category. And right now, it's 1 in every 36, which is alarming. I mean, when we started, when the foundation was formed, there, and again, the diagnosis and stuff wasn't as prevalent, but it was like 1 in 10,000. And then a few years back, you know, probably about 10 years, it was 1 in 1,000. And like I said, now the latest is 1 in 36, which just 2 years ago is 1 in 44. People ask me, well, is there better diagnosis, or, you know, or what's happening? Are they just expanding what autism is? And, you know, it's real numbers. There is no cause defined or cure defined for autism, but there's somewhere in between that is genetic and or environmental. I mean, you know, that's the difficulty with autism is that there's a lot of genes that contribute, but they've not found one specific. And typically they'll look at, there's a child with autism may have gastro issues and things like that. So there's certain common, like I said, comorbidities, but there's still not that one cure or that reason, that cause. And so, and I'm not an expert. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. So I always, you know, I just run a foundation and try to serve people. So, you know, I always say go to the experts and speak with them, but I think that I'm generalizing and they're going to tell you the same thing. But there really are, the other thing is they say, well, in the U.S., you know, is it diet? Is that, but if you go to other countries, that rate is about the same. And what is, frustrating, you know, when you work with medical care and getting therapies and treatments, you know, if I always said, if one day we woke up and one in every 36 people maybe were being born without an arm or something like that, and it may not be a great example, but there would be a lot of concern, you know, and so we really do have to put more dollars, you know, from government, from agencies. I mean, we really do have to work together to try to understand autism more.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We're proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
Well, I'll just let it go at that, yeah.
Chief Executive Officer for the Dan Marino Foundation, Mary Parton. You can learn more about all the different programs and services they provide and the work that they do at danmarinofoundation.org. Again, that's danmarinofoundation.org. Mary, really appreciate the tremendous work you and your entire team are doing on this issue, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, we really appreciate the opportunity, Ryan, and just if anyone listening, we're here to be your resource, to help guide, and so please contact us.
All right, thanks again, Mary. I'm Ryan Gorman here on iHeartRadio Communities, and now I want to bring in our next guest. We're joined by Dr. Mitchell Elkins, Chief Clinical Science Officer for the American Heart Association. May is American Stroke Month, and you can learn more at stroke.org/strokemonth. That's stroke.org/strokemonth. Dr. Elkin, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to come on the show. And let me start with a very basic question. What exactly is a stroke?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks a lot, Ryan, for having me and the American Heart Association on the show. So a stroke is essentially damage to the brain that's caused by a problem with a blood vessel. So most of the time, about 80% of the time, it's due to a blood clot blocking a blood vessel, leading to a lack of blood flow to that part of the brain that's affected, and that's what causes the damage. About 20% of the time, it's due to a breakage or a rupture of the blood vessel, leading to bleeding into the brain. So that's called a hemorrhagic stroke, and that can be pretty damaging as well.
Something that I think can confuse people from time to time, the difference between a heart attack, a stroke, and cardiac arrest. Can you break that down for us?
Oh, yeah, sure. So a heart attack is when there's lack of blood flow to a part of the heart, and so that part of the heart is damaged. Sometimes because of a heart attack or because of an underlying rhythm problem with the heart, there can be what's called a cardiac arrest, which is when the heart stops beating completely and the person becomes completely unresponsive. A stroke, on the other hand, is when the problem is in the brain, not in the heart. So that's when the lack of blood flow or bleeding into the brain causes the problem. So it's affecting a different organ from either a heart attack or a sudden cardiac arrest.
And to focus in on strokes again for a moment, how many Americans deal with this each year?
It's a big problem. So there are about 800,000 strokes a year in the United States. Stroke is the fifth leading cause of death in the U.S., and because strokes often don't kill people but leave them with disability, it's actually the leading cause of serious long-term disability in the U.S. And interestingly, in other parts of the world, strokes actually outrank heart disease as a cause of death. So worldwide, it's the number two cause of death, even though here in the U.S. it's number five, because we have other significant causes ahead of it here.
Are certain demographics more at risk for suffering from a stroke?
Absolutely. So first of all, stroke risk does increase with age. So it actually goes up pretty quickly as people get over the age of 55. In fact, it doubles for every decade of age after the age of 55. So it goes up rapidly there. But it's important to remember that stroke isn't only a condition of older people. In fact, we've seen stroke rates going up in this country among younger people, people in their 20s and 30s and midlife. And that's obviously a cause of great concern. But stroke can affect somebody at any age. And in fact, even children can have strokes. And those can be both ischemic and hemorrhagic strokes. So we don't ever want to forget that possibility. And as physicians, certainly we need to remember that if someone has symptoms of a stroke, that we shouldn't disregard those symptoms. They could, in fact, be manifestations of a stroke. The other major thing to remember is that African Americans, Black Americans, have about twice the risk of stroke as the white population. And this, of course, is a great cause of concern and something that many people are trying to change. And we think a lot of that is due to increased rates of high blood pressure in the Black population. Other populations in the U.S. also seem to be at increased risk of stroke, including Hispanic or Latino Americans.
Is there a difference between men and women?
Well, the absolute numbers of stroke are higher among women than men because women tend to live longer than men, and so they live into the older age ranges when strokes are more likely to occur. So there are greater numbers of stroke in women overall, but at middle age, men tend to have a slightly higher risk of stroke. At younger ages, women may actually have a slightly increased risk because of hormonal factors. Pregnancy, for example, does increase the risk of stroke slightly, and so do hormonal therapies, for example. So it sort of depends on the age at which one is looking. Overall, there are more strokes in women because they tend to live longer.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Dr. Mitchell Elkind, Chief Clinical Science Officer for the American Heart Association. May is American Stroke Month, and you can learn more at stroke.org/strokemonth. What are some of the stroke risk factors that listeners need to be aware of to prevent a stroke?
Well, there's several risk factors for stroke. The most important one, perhaps even number one, two, and three, would be high blood pressure. And that's because high blood pressure, first of all, is very common in the United States and worldwide, and it has a very strong association with stroke. So it's been estimated that high blood pressure accounts for about 50% of strokes and perhaps as many as 80% of the hemorrhagic or bleeding kind of stroke. So that's the most important risk factor. Other important risk factors, though, are diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, smoking, and even heart disease. A lot of the risk factors that I've just mentioned are, in fact, risk factors for heart disease as well. So the things that lead to heart disease tend to also lead to stroke as well. We have a kind of easy way for people to remember what the risk factors are for both heart disease and stroke at the Heart Association, and that's the Life's Essential Eight concept, which includes blood pressure, high glucose or sugar levels, cholesterol, smoking, a lack of physical activity, an unhealthy diet, heavy weight or obesity, and a lack of sleep. So all of those contribute to the risk of stroke and heart disease.
Now, what about some of the signs and symptoms of someone who is potentially suffering from a stroke?
Sure. So strokes, because they're damage to the brain, they can cause symptoms that represent any of the different functions of the brain. But the way that we think it's easiest for people to remember this is through a simple acronym called FAST, F-A-S-T. And that reminds us that if you see someone whose face is drooping, that's F. If they have any arm weakness, they can't hold up one of their arms, that's A. And if they have speech difficulty, that's either trouble speaking or understanding speech, then it's T, time to call 911 and get emergency help right away. So that's the FAST, easy way to remember the symptoms of a stroke.
What about treatment options for someone who has suffered from a stroke? And how much have we advanced in recent years in terms of being able to treat stroke victims?
Really terrific questions, Ryan. So first of all, yes, there are treatments available for stroke, and we've seen absolutely tremendous advances in the last couple of decades in stroke care. The key thing is that T that I mentioned. It's time to call 911. We say time is brain. Treatment has to be started as quickly after the stroke symptoms begin to be effective. And the longer one waits, the less likely it is to be of benefit. So we can use clot-busting drugs for those ischemic strokes where the problem is a blockage in a blood vessel. But those have to be given in an emergency room after bleeding stroke has been excluded, using generally a CAT scan or CT scan to rule out bleeding in the brain. And so those clot-busting medicines like TPA or tissue plasminogen activator, for example, have to be given within no more than 4.5 hours after the stroke has begun generally. So super important to get to the hospital right away. And then for people with larger strokes, sometimes even out as long as 24 hours after the stroke has begun, we can use an interventional procedure where an interventional neuroradiologist or endovascular neurosurgeon can thread a catheter into the blood vessels up to the brain and remove the clot directly, mechanically from the brain. We call that a mechanical thrombectomy. The results can be absolutely dramatic. People who come in paralyzed on one side of the body and unable to speak can have a complete reversal and walk out of the hospital in a day or two. But it's important to get to the hospital to get that treatment done, of course, and only those with certain types of strokes may be eligible for it.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Dr. Mitchell Elkins, Chief Clinical Science Officer for the American Heart Association. May is American Stroke Month, and you can learn more at stroke.org/stroke month. I know you mentioned earlier some conditions that could increase risk factors for stroke include high blood pressure, obesity. Are there other medical conditions that can also increase the risk? And if someone already had a stroke, what is the likelihood that they could get one again?
Sure. Well, first of all, yeah, the other things that are important to remember are, I think I mentioned this briefly before, heart diseases, but in particular, one that's very common is called atrial fibrillation. This is an irregular rhythm of the heart that can lead to blood clots forming in the heart that can then travel to the brain and cause a stroke. And that condition, atrial fibrillation, is very common, particularly as people age. And they can check their own pulse to see if they have it. If you feel an irregular rhythm to your pulse, it's worth talking to your doctor about it because it can have a big impact by putting someone on a blood thinner to prevent stroke. So that's one important thing to remember. And it's absolutely true that once somebody has a stroke, they're at increased risk of having another one, probably because the risk factors that led to the first one are still present and increase the risk of having a second one. There's a lot we can do, though, to reduce the risk of another stroke, including treating things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and also using medicines like aspirin or stronger blood thinners if somebody has a condition like atrial fibrillation. So those are the kinds of things we have to do. But we first of all have to know why somebody has a stroke. So I always think of it in terms of both the cause of the stroke as well as treating the risk factors. So by cause, I mean, does someone have an underlying heart condition like atrial fibrillation? Do they have a blockage in the blood vessel in the neck, the carotid artery, that could be treated with surgery, for example? We want to address those problems when we discover them on the patient's evaluation. Then we also want to address the risk factors that are present, like the high blood pressure, unhealthy diet or obesity, high cholesterol, smoking cessation is essential, and so forth. So it's a combination of treating the cause that we think was the direct reason someone had a stroke, as well as taking care of those risk factors that increase the risk of stroke, heart disease, and other problems.
And finally, with this being American Stroke Month, where can people find out more information about all of this?
Absolutely. So the best place to look is at the American Heart Association website. And specifically for information about stroke, go to stroke.org/strokemonth. But stroke.org, simple to remember. Check it out.
All right. For American Stroke Month, Dr. Mitchell Elkins, Chief Clinical Science Officer from the American Heart Association. Dr. Elkin, thank you so much for taking the time to step us through all of that. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me and for having the American Heart Association.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. I'm your host, Ryan Gorman. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
In my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.